The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Speaking, and he says in verse 3, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so men persecuted the prophets who were before you." Our text is verse 7, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy." Now, in the parallel material in Luke 6, this beatitude as such is not repeated, but certainly it's spelled out here in much greater fullness than in Matthew. So we'll just read that part of it. Luke chapter 6, starting with verse 27. Luke 6, starting with verse 27. "But I say to you that here, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. To him who strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from him who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your coat as well. Give to everyone who begs from you. And of him who takes away your goods, do not ask them again. And as you wish that men would do to you, do so to them. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you hope to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High. For he is kind to the ungrateful and the selfish. Be merciful, even as your Father is merciful. Judge not, and you will not be judged. Condemn not, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. For the measure you give will be the measure you get back." You might agree that Jesus is the greatest teacher who ever lived. And I talked to an old pastor one time, and I asked him, well, really it wasn't a direct conversation, it was to another man, but the question was, what was the secret of, whenever he preached, the churches grew? And he said, it's very simple, no problem at all. To get people to come to listen to you, you do one or two things, maybe both. One, tell them what they don't know. Two, tell them what they don't like to hear. And he says, if you do that in preaching, people will always come. Now, that was an odd thing for him to say, but you notice when you listen to Jesus, he seems to major in both those points. He tells us what we certainly wouldn't have thought of ourselves. We certainly wouldn't have dreamed up this kind of a life described in Luke 6 or in Matthew 5. And it certainly doesn't appeal to us. We may think it does. If we could put it on a gold lettering on a plaque, it does. The rhetoric of it just appeals, you know, flows. And it sounds noble. But then if you tried to get us to write it on our hearts, it doesn't turn to gold. There's a, sort of a lead or steel plate in there that doesn't want too much written on it of this kind of thing. In other words, we resist what we find here. And if you know yourself, you know you do resist it. And this call to be merciful is probably one of the areas where we resist most of all. So now, the way I'd like to proceed is to take it out of my hands and put it where it really belongs, and that's with the teacher, with Jesus and you. No way could any human being teach you what he's put down here unless he did it. Would you agree with that? And so that I won't be frustrated here by trying to teach you what you absolutely do not intend to learn, and both of us being frustrated by my efforts, let's recognize right out at the outset that Jesus is the teacher here. The fact that you're sitting in that particular chair on this particular day, you might have various explanations. I came here because I was bored with the afternoon, you know, or I was restless, or it's my habit to come here in the afternoon, or whatever it may be. But you see, the person who really led you on that route that brought you to that chair is Jesus Christ. And therefore, he wants to meet with you on these matters. Jesus wants to be your instructor. He wants to be in partnership with you and show you how you can live this out and bring much joy into your life. And so when he says here, blessed are the merciful, in Matthew 5, verse 7, what does he want to tell you? Well, let's begin by asking ourselves what it means here to be merciful. You know, I was telling the other day in the morning service that when I grew up, that our family moved away from the Rogue River in Oregon because the bad guys lived along the Rogue River. Remember that? Some of you were there. Okay. We were the good guys. We moved over the river to another river where we could be nice and decent. And that was what it was. And the thing in my life, though, is as I came back, I had to go to town to go to school, was I found it wasn't just the guys from the river who did bad things, but it was other people did, too. And the thing that was appalling to me as I grew up was that the nice people, the business people, when I was about, I think around 9, there was a businessman. He had a dairy and marketed the dairy products. I had been up in the mountains with my brother at his lookout in the Forest Service, and there was an old German settler there who fled from Germany to get out of conscription. And these two, this farmer, or this businessman with the dairy, he and this old German had been friends for years. And while I was standing there, now imagine, about 9 years old, maybe even a little younger, and looking at these two people that I admired, the thing that hit me is I listened, and they got into an argument, and pretty soon they were threatening to kill each other. Now think about that. And you know, somehow that didn't connect with what I was getting in Sunday school. You see, it didn't seem to come together. And then when I was a little older yet, I was in the sixth grade, we went on a picnic. We went with the fifth graders, you know, it wasn't a very big school. And so we went down to a place called Hunter's Creek, and there was a rock there and a pool. And I and a friend of mine were on the other side of the pool. And as we looked up, we heard a cry, and we looked up, and here came a red-haired boy who couldn't swim, but he did happen to be swimming, through that pool. And we could swim, and we jumped in and dragged him out and so on, and said, what were we doing in that pool? That was really a dumb thing to do. You can't swim getting in that pool. He said, well, I didn't jump into that pool. He said, Neil pushed me. I knew there was a grudge between the two of them, but Neil actually tried to kill him. Well, you can say, Oregon obviously is a rough place. I'm glad I never went west, young man. If even the nice kids are like that, you know, I don't even want to hear what it was like over at the river. Well, you're right. That's kind of what it was. The side of the mountain was kind of rough. But the thing was, it struck me, was when you begin to take the wraps off of people, they all were pretty mean and pretty vicious. And I couldn't seem to find answers to that in Sunday school or in church. And what you seem to get from the church that I went to is that we're all kind of good people here. And so what you got was there's sort of two levels, a veneer over the top, and then where people really live, and there just seemed to be no way of bringing those together. And as a teenager, I became very cynical because I thought Christianity was mostly words. And reality and those words didn't go together. That you could read all you wanted about being merciful, but people aren't very merciful. And you see the tension that was there for me. And I think for our own children, they have a right to see that this is not just words. Isn't this true? They need to see that this really can be worked out. And so I'd like to just say that put your faith in the teacher, and he can do this for you. I want you to challenge your own heart. And yes, even Jesus, in a way, Lord, I'm going to put myself in your hands for you to teach me what this means. In a world where I'm not very merciful by instinct or nature, where others are not, where we just go in the opposite direction, I want you to teach me. You help me, please. And so as we look at the words that Jesus gives us here, you'll notice this word for merciful, it's sort of a big word, it's sort of spread out, it could cover almost everything in the world. But if you look at it in the original, or maybe some more modern translation, it really is a word that means pretty close to very tender hearted. Jesus is saying, blessed are those who are compassionate in their hearts. Now, when he says that, he's not saying blessed are the hard-hearted, but he's saying that those who are under the blessing of those who are very pitiful, those who pity others. And if you want to get an example of how this is used, turn with me to Matthew chapter 9, verse 27. It's really the same idea completely. Jesus is passing by, he's walking by, and here we read, as he passes by, two blind men followed him, crying aloud, have pity on us, son of David. Have pity upon us. Now, can you imagine what those men were doing? If you really wanted help from Jesus, can't you imagine how they were talking? I suppose they came along like this, didn't they? Jesus, have pity on us. Right? If you really wanted help, and you know that this fellow gets out of reach and can't hear you, and the only last hope you have is your voice reaching him, how's it going to come out? He goes down the road, no hope, you're blind, yeah?
Have pity on me, Jesus! Lord, have you ever listened? Listen now!
Man, you would make him hear. And so you see what you're getting when you talk about this word, you're talking about depths of human emotion. When people really stand up and make known what they feel. I'm sorry for waking up all the babies, or any one of the rest of you, I woke up. If your afternoon nap is ruined, you'll have to blame the text, because I really believe that is the sense of this word here. It's not a quiet, reserved term. It is that which involves the deepest compassion from the person who extends it, and also, in the case of those who are asking for it, the deepest need. And so that's what I think it really is. Now, if you look at the passage, we haven't tried in any way to fill a lot of content into it yet, but I want you now to look at the form of it. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Again, what you have here is a promise that if you have this kind of a heart, tender, compassionate, not a heart of stone, but a heart of the new covenant, one of flesh, that you are going to have lots of pity shown to you by God. Lots of compassion, lots of grace. If you are merciful, and really here we've got to add the word, to others. Now you'll notice there's a change coming on. As we've gone down the Beatitudes, we came to blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are the meek, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Now these are all primarily upward. They go towards God, don't they? Isn't that true? All of these first four go primarily towards God. But now when we come to the merciful, we're really talking about a human way of which all of this relates to others. And so now we're talking about how you treat others. And God says, if you have a tender heart towards others, you're going to have God having a tender heart towards you. Did you ever have the sneaking feeling that God might not be happy with you? Did you ever have that wake up some morning before you could think, you said, man, I wonder what God thinks about me this morning? You felt that way, huh? Well, you see, this passage says that you can know that he's really for you if you are showing compassion to others. If you are showing mercy, if you are being kind, God says you are going to obtain mercy. It's a promise. Blessed are the merciful. Happy are the merciful, for they shall have mercy from God. That's really the sense of it. And so what you have then is I relate outwardly in this way by kindness, but then when I relate that way, then God relates to me by kindness. Do you see the pattern now? And so we really don't lose the vertical relationship with God. With every act of kindness, you see, God is returning mercy to us,
And of course, at the final judgment day, when we appear before the Lord, and he says, well, are you a sheep or a goat? And then he says, the sheep all come over here to the right. I almost got that backwards. I almost put the sheep on the left. I just remembered the Lord said, I'll put the sheep on the right. And what were the nature? What's the nature of the sheep on the right? It's right out of Matthew 25. They all showed mercy to other believers. Those are the sheep. And what are the goats? Those who ended up, by surprise, on the right. Those are the ones who didn't show mercy. And so God, you see, is watching what people do. And when people do that which is merciful, they're proving out that they really are sheep. Now, this means that we've got to say a little bit about what it doesn't mean. It does not mean that you earn, by your deeds of mercy, God's forgiveness and your justification. But rather, because you have been justified and forgiven by Christ, you do deeds of mercy which show that you're one who's been justified. It's the fruit, then, of the kind of living that shows you've got the root in Jesus Christ. And he's saying if you don't have any fruit, then you don't have any root. It's as simple as that. So he's not talking about justification by works. He's saying those who claim to be redeemed, they can be assured they are redeemed and God's mercy is with them because the fruit of that is appearing in their lives. And that means mercy to others. And so we could put then the pattern like this. I myself have been very weak and miserable and wretched in need of God's pity. Right? I'm like the blind man spiritually. I'm a sinner by nature. I go astray instinctively. My record of mercy, I didn't threaten to shoot anybody when I saw those two men get ready to kill each other, but the same heart was in me. And so God showed grace to me by giving his son Jesus. Jesus died for me. He had pity upon me. And when he had pity on me, therefore, I show pity to others. If I don't show mercy to others, how do I know Christ and I are friends? Did you ever hear that saying? You're all too young probably to hear it, but after you live together long enough, people begin to look like each other. Well, I don't know whether it's really true, but it is with Jesus. When you live long enough with him, you begin to look like him. And that's what he's saying then, that you're really Christ's representative in the world. It's how he distributes mercy around. And if you do this, then that shows that you have found mercy already in him. So it's not legalism, it's not what you've earned, but it's because you have had free forgiveness, because you've been pardoned, then that you know how to give it to others. Let me give an example from C.S. Lewis. Have any of you ever read C.S. Lewis? Okay, good. Have you ever read The Voyage of the Dawn Treader? Okay, remember that little scene in there where Eustace, well, let's take a few steps back. Eustace, what is he like? Well, I couldn't say he's a good American because he's a good Englishman, but he's basically nasty and vicious like the rest of the human race. He's worked at it and he's organized it and he's ornery. And therefore, there's not a bone of mercy in him towards anyone else. His favorite thing is complaining. He complains. And he also loves money. And when he wanders into this hole and lies down on what looks like some rocky things, he actually is lying in a dragon's lair. As those of you who know about dragons know that dragons lie in lairs, and they always lie on gold and silver and jewels, you know. And so what he's been doing is he's behaving like a dragon. And so when he lies down there in the dragon's lair, he's turned into a dragon. His behavior is dragon-like, he's vicious, nasty, and he gets the outfit to equate himself with it. So he now becomes a dragon. And this is a terrible thing, and he goes around trying to get rid of his dragon-ness, and he can't do it. And it's kind of a picture of a man who can't change what he is, and he can't. And so finally he meets this lion, Aslan, who's a picture of Christ. And here's what Aslan tells him. The lion told me, there's a pool, by the way, there, it's going to help him. And the lion told me I must undress first. I scratched and pulled off one skin, and I found underneath that dragon skin, there was another dragon skin. And he scratched and pulled off that, and underneath that dragon skin, there was another dragon skin. And he took one final scratch and took off the other, a third, and there was still a dragon skin underneath. And then the lion said to you, Eustace, you will have to let me undress you. I was afraid of his claws, I can tell you, but I was pretty nearly desperate now. So I just lay flat on my back to let him do it. The very first tear he made was so deep that I thought it had gone right into my heart. And when he began pulling the skin off, it hurt worse than anything I ever felt. Then he caught hold of me. I didn't like that much, for I was as smooth and as soft as a peeled switch and smaller than I had been. Then he caught hold of me and threw me into the water. It smarted like anything, but only for a moment. After that, it became perfectly delicious, and as soon as I started swimming and splashing, I found that all my pain had gone from my arm, and then I saw why I had turned into a boy again. Now, the reason I've read that to you is to point out to you that what we are by nature, and it must be a radical work of God through Christ to change us and to take off our dragonish behavior, the viciousness, the meanness. But the whole world is like that. Americans, English, Ugandans, they're all like that. But then even more, that behind that, there is the pity, the mercy of Jesus, in that before he could cause us to have this kind of new birth and this kind of change in which we lose our ugly skin, he had to die for us and take away our sin and our guilt. And that pity was like no other pity, that mercy like no other mercy. And you see, it's this then that makes the power come into the text. Jesus wants us to see how much he loved us, how much he gave for us. Now, if you don't see that, it may be you've got a dragon skin on. Do you think about that? That you might be wearing a dragon skin and not know it? That would be a shock. If you were to wake up tomorrow morning and you were really not a human being, but a dragon. Or maybe it might be turned into something else creative. Maybe you became a cockroach, a big cockroach lying there in bed. This is what you really like, self-centered cockroach. And you'd say, could anyone pity a cockroach? And the Lord says, yes, I pity cockroaches. And if you're a spiritual cockroach, I want you to look to my Son and see his pity upon you. Now you see, when you begin to see, if we could really ever see ourselves as God saw us, we would be just broken into 1,000 pieces. And so when we were outside of Christ, we were such wretched, miserable people. And so that is the thing that God wants to bring to us, that we really be broken by the love of God and see the greatness of his pity and then show that to others. Sometimes I illustrate it like this, that suppose you know somebody that you've shown mercy to, a lot of mercy, right? You all know somebody like that? Maybe you don't. Maybe you've not shown any mercy to anyone. But maybe you've shown them a little mercy, and they didn't even thank you afterwards, right? Right? And so your instinct is dragonishly to, you know, let your hands meet as you go through there. But now you see what the Lord is saying is that you have such a gift of salvation with so much mercy coming as all this love from God. You don't have any hand free to choke them because you have your hand up here taking God's grace. If God, you see, in the matter of forgiveness, what could anyone possibly do to you that could compare with what you've done to God? Do you see? And that's why if you get these eyes from Jesus and see it this way, he can really teach you so that no longer will you ever be a prisoner again of someone else's dragonishness. I don't know whether I've got the right word here, but I'm working on it. Dragonishness. I don't know. Dragonness, I guess we'll make it. Someone else's bad viciousness. And so here is where it's tested. Remember, Marlene came over to our house, and here she is, a nurse. And as I explained to you, nurses and doctors for Aunt Barbara are... And so Marlene was working hard here, and after she watched me work with Aunt Barbara, she says, boy, I've seen Aunt Barbara at church, and I didn't realize how stubborn she could be, you know, and we're talking about it. And yeah, I said, well, she's at least as stubborn as I am, and so we were talking about all of this, and Marlene came day after day caring for her, and how many times do you suppose Aunt Barbara thanked her? How many? Zero. Goose egg. And Barbara didn't want Marlene to come. She would have been happy if Marlene didn't come. But you see, when Marlene was rejected, she loved Barbara enough that she kept coming. And you see, when Jesus came and died for us, how many of us thanked him before he did it? Nobody did. Nobody. And the same thing then is when you and I give ourselves to someone else. If we're being influenced by what they do or don't do, then are we really being influenced by the pity from above, mercy from above? And so what we really saw then in Marlene, as she persisted, she had pity that acted. And I want to use this now to give you a clearer understanding of the text. Look back at the text again. Blessed are the merciful. It's a little more active than that. It's blessed are those who have a tender heart, which does something, which shows mercy, which not only has a good attitude, but reveals itself in merciful actions, which persists and perseveres. You see, the whole idea of somebody needing pity is that that person is very weak and likely very unattractive, and probably somehow they got themselves in the mess, and so the person who's going to help them has to go a long way down to help them. And so the challenge then is this: are you going to be led, if you're a believer, by the flesh, which says, give to those who thank you, give to those who give to you, welcome to your table those who can welcome you back, or are you going to show God's mercy in this world? See, there's the meaning of it. The meaning of the passage then, that word merciful, which God promises to bless, has in it the idea of a very compassionate, tender, forgiving heart, but which acts out in reaching out and continuing to reach out. In other words, what he's talking about here is a lifestyle which goes on and on and on and on and on. That is what it is to be a Christian. You see, what is Jesus giving us here but descriptions of what the Christian life is? These are not simply exhortations. These are statements of fact. They're beatitudes. Those who are happy, who are this way, and these are Christians. A new age has come. The Holy Spirit has entered into the world, and he has power to enable you to do these things. Now, if that's so, wow. Jesus, then, can do a lot for you. Because that is the kind of person he is in the business of building. He's not in the business of building dragons. He is in the business of getting rid of dragons and dragon skins and building human beings who act like human beings as God originally designed them in the creation. Praise God. Isn't that beautiful? Now, what that means then, if we're going to think about ourselves then, is that we need some kind of key to pull it together. Otherwise, it's an exhortation which you might lose about Wednesday or Monday morning or the end of the Sunday school hour, right? You need something a little bit more to put your teeth in that makes it specific. And so I'd like to call your attention over here to Luke chapter 6 and just call this to your mind. It seems to me here is a rule or a principle you can follow. Right there in verse 31, right in that teaching of Jesus about showing mercy, here's what he says. And as you wish that men would do to you, do so to them. It's significant to me that the golden rule is in the setting of showing mercy. Whatever you wish that men do to you in the Matthew form, you do to them. And here is whatever is essentially the same. As you wish, what you wish that men would do to you, do so to them. Now, I think this clears up a great deal of nonsense. Because you might say, when Marlene came in the door and Aunt Barbara saw her and didn't want her there, Marlene, if she did what Barbara wanted her to do, she would have gone home, right? So Barbara had the golden rule and Marlene didn't. Really? No, we misunderstand. What the golden rule is, if I were in Barbara's position, if I were in Barbara's position, what would I want done to me? I would want done to me what Marlene did because it would be the best for me. Do you see? In other words, we don't give in to everyone's feelings about what they want, but rather we are guided by the fact that I, as a mature Christian, or I hopefully am, maybe not, but I'm striving, okay? You as a more mature Christian, as you see a weaker brother or someone who's a non-Christian, and when you put yourself in their place, you don't do what they want you to do, but you do to them what you would want done to you if you were in their place. Do you see the difference? There is a big difference. Because most people want us to cater to their dragonishness. I got it out finally. The golden rule is, if I were in Barbara's position, what would I want done to me? I would want done to me what Marlene did, because it would be the best for me. You see? In other words, we don't give in to everyone's feelings about what they want, but rather we are guided by the fact that I, as a mature Christian, or I hopefully am, maybe not, but I'm striving, okay? You, as a more mature Christian, as you see a weaker brother, or someone who's a non-Christian, and when you put yourself in their place, you don't do what they want you to do, but you do to them what you would want done to you if you were in their place. Do you see the difference? There is a big difference. Because most people want us to cater to their dragonishness. I got it out finally. Now we can say it together, dragonishness, okay? Most people are happy to be dragons. I'm unhappy. You're unhappy with their being dragons. And so what I do to help them is not to go down and be a dragon with them, but I put myself in their position and say, I wouldn't want to be a dragon. Therefore, I'm going to perhaps confront them even with their sin. Now to do that, though, you notice this whole idea of the golden rule. If you put yourself in the other person's place, you've got to do some dying. Because what do we instinctively want? We want other people to put themselves in our place. Don't we say that? Oh, if you would just understand me. If you would just put yourself in my place. And so we reverse this rule, and Jesus says, no, if you're really merciful, you'll put yourself in that other person's position. And according now to the text, get back to Matthew chapter 5, verse 7, you'll do it with such a tender heart, the person will know Jesus is speaking to him. He might hate you for it, but the compassion you show, the love you show, will show that Christ was there. And so it becomes a kind of a tough love in which you've renounced your self-centeredness in putting yourself in another person's place. Now, one time, there was a woman. I served a church out in Bucks County. It was called Mechanicsville Chapel, and there's a woman there named Joan. And Joan was probably the most converted person in the church. My wife and I had converted her at least once, and Billy Graham at least once, too. So you can see she was in very good shape, except she didn't seem to have any spiritual power. She had all the dragonish qualities, she later told us. And we had prayed for her some, a good deal maybe, and nothing happened until one day she had 60 convulsions and was taken to a hospital. And I showed up and we got talking and I said, well, Joan, we're not children any longer. And when you have 60 convulsions in one day, that's kind of serious business, isn't it? What would happen if you would go to be with the Lord? Would you be welcome? You know, what kind of relationship do you have with him? And I had a few sneaking suspicions that all these conversions, either mine or Billy Graham's, might not have been the Lord's. And she said, well, Pastor, until today, I would have said, I know I'll be with the Lord. But she says, now that I think about it, might happen. I'm not so sure. And so I did something that was a radical break in my pastoral career. I was never the same since. I had some changes before it happened, but I was never the same since once I did this. I went to her for about 10 days, maybe 2 weeks, and I simply took the book of Romans, chapter 1, and I read from verse 16 right in the rest of the chapter. On the one side, you have the power of the gospel, through faith, the righteousness of Christ, reckoned to our account, and the other side, you have the wrath of God. Well, now, what a pastoral counselor that is, to go to a hospital and read somebody about the choice between free grace and the wrath of God. About faith being in Christ and under his righteousness, a legal thing, accepted, forgiven, pardoned, or being under the ashes of our own life now and ready to pass into an eternity where you perish forever. I still did it. She told me at the end of that period, she said she hated me. I suspect she always did hate me. People who are running from their pastor have a love-hate relationship there. They sort of want to be near him and then they want to get away. Want to be near him, want to get away, you know. And there's actually around our block, I'm sure there's a special rot worn by people trying to get up their nerve to come in. I'm sure Ron has got one developing around his house, I'm sure. He gets a little older, he'll be able to detect it up front. But anyway, she was one of those people who really had that kind of relationship with every Christian that was serious about eternal things. And so naturally, I knew she hated me. by the time I was through. But the day I came in, after about 10 days, she was sitting on the edge of her bed, and there was a radiant, holy light on her face. At the time, I probably wouldn't have used the words holy, but obviously you couldn't miss the light. And she picked up her Bible, and there was a seminary student with me, Dave was his name, and she ran to me and that seminary student, and she says, I have it, I have believed, I've got it, you know? And so we say, well, what do you got? And she grabbed us and headed us down to the solarium, and she says, you know, I understand. What do you understand? Well, I understand what you've been telling me, you know, a big grin all over her face. And so, and she says, I'm so excited about Jesus, I've got the joy of salvation. And she says, my life now is so different. I know the Lord. I know, if you ask me that question again, I can tell you I'd be with Jesus. I have that kind of knowledge now. And she says, my only problem now is I'm going from bed to bed. Now, mind you, she's been a pretty sick little lady. And she says, I'm going from bed to bed telling people about Jesus and asking them if they really know Romans 1. So, Romans 1 was getting some pretty heavy treatment through that hospital. And so the only problem we had with her, as she was so aware of God's mercy to her, was trying to slow her down so she didn't make herself sick or upset all the patients in the hospital at once with this turned-on witnessing. Now, the thing was, and the reason I used that is I began to realize as I meditated, I've been writing lately, you know, and I've been writing about some of these things, I realized how sinful it is not to love people enough to persevere even when they hate you. You've really put yourself in the place. Now, to my shame, what did it take me? I've been a pastor for a long time before I did that. Now, God, what God wants to say to you is, look, you don't have to invent the wheel again. You don't have to make all of Jack Miller's mistakes. I can teach you about these things now. They're not a matter of education, length of experience. They're a matter of my being your teacher. I had to wait for him for so long because he was so proud. And because he was so proud, I knew he would boast about it if I didn't let him make a lot of mistakes ahead of time so he could see the record up there in big and black and white. But now for you, God says to you, you don't have to wait that long to learn how to love, to learn how to pity, to have compassion, and to bring to it a firmness of purpose, a commitment to the holiness of God's people, the holiness of the church, and the glory being given to Christ for that. You see, if Christ is speaking to you today, he can give you a good beginning. The difference is entirely going to be grace. If you ask him for grace, and here's the way I'd like to suggest you pray. As you think about this, Lord, as I look at myself, and I think about myself, I tend to judge people. My special gift is criticism. If we were to analyze the gifts in the church, I would put that down as my talent. I enjoy being negative. It makes me feel better to pull other people down. I forgive on a very selective basis. In fact, sometimes the whole grudges, and they're so deep, I don't even know I've got them. I don't know how to put on a lifestyle of forgiving, which really issues out of this passage. I don't know how to put on a lifestyle of blessing people. Well, remember that cry that scared you to death earlier, and everybody woke up and ruined your afternoon's nap? That's the way the Lord wants you to pray. Now, you don't have to yell as loud as I did. We don't want to wake up any of the babies again, right? But if you would pray simply, Lord, Lord, have pity upon me. If you ever had pity upon anyone, have pity upon me, because I can't get any of this in my system. I instinctively do the opposite. I've got a dragon skin on me that's thick like armor plate. Lord, if you ever love me now. Take over in my life and give me a kind of practical Christianity that gets right down into the way I forgive, the way I don't judge, the way I do my job, the way I live with those over me in authority, the way I live with those who are alongside of me, my husband, my wife, and the way I live with my children, that I really will bring to all of these relationships a perseverance, a setness of purpose, a clarity of eye, but a deep compassion. And so, Lord, I want that, and I couldn't possibly invent that. I couldn't create that in me. My problem is like getting the dragon skin off. I almost need to be converted again every day. Do you see what the issues are? Will you pray that way? Bob Heppe, when he first met me, I gave him a new life booklet, and I just picked it out of my pocket. I occasionally have one with me, and so I handed one over to him, and he took it, and he read it. And he came back the next day, and we saw it maybe a couple of days later. And he said, well, I read it. Sort of a silly grin on his face. He was tipsy as usual, at least tipsy, maybe worse. And he said, I prayed that prayer in there, and it didn't do a thing. I've been one of those rare times where pastors keep their mouths shut. I didn't say anything. Very rare, but they do happen. And as I stood there and just waiting for Bob, he said, do you mean I should go back and mean it? And said, word. God's waiting. God, show me mercy. God doesn't say a thing. He's just quiet. He's just waiting. And you come back and you say, Lord, I think I should come and try it again and mean it.